Christine, would you please come up to the lovely podium of power and introduce today's guest speaker?
Okay. So Dave comes to Organic from Unplugged, a Toronto-based interactive studio. At Unplugged, Dave led a team through the creative execution of The Adventures of Seinfeld and Superman, a pioneering branded entertainment project for American Express starring Jerry Seinfeld and directed by Academy Award-winning director Barry Levinson. With Organic, Dave has worked with an eclectic roster of clients including Sprint, Armani Exchange, Sirius Satellite Radio, Tommy Hilfiger, and the Royal Bank of Canada. His team's work on the Tommy Kids site was awarded Best Fashion Site at the 2005 Web Awards. Dave was a panelist at the 2004 SXSW Interactive Festival in Austin, Texas. As well, he presented the Seinfeld and Superman webisodes at the InfoPress Beyond the Banner conference in Montreal. Over the past few years, he has been a judge for the Clio, Digital Marketing, Applied Arts, Media Innovation, and Flash at the Cannes Awards. So let's welcome Dave.
Thank you. I decided that what I would probably do is show you a whole bunch of examples of what I do. I work for a digital advertising agency, we're called Organic. We're based in Toronto. The company was founded in San Francisco back in the early 90s, one of the first companies to do advertising and marketing for the internet. It has offices in Detroit, where we do a lot of work for Daimler Chrysler, Jeep, and I'm going to show some examples of that. Offices in New York and offices in Toronto. And, you know, when I came over to Organic, they sort of brought me in because I was a little bit of a specialist within my field. Some people build sites that are transactional, that allow you to shop. Some people build, you know, big marketing platforms. My whole thing is branded entertainment. When I knew David as a painter, my work was always really narrative. It was always really about storytelling. That's always been my focus. And branded entertainment is a kind of really interesting niche, and some people say very timely, because we live in a world where people are running away from advertisements with TiVo, with all kinds of, you know, there's all kinds of data to suggest that, you know, the age of mass advertising is over. So how do you get your brand in front of someone, and especially with the web, which is, you know, what they call opt-in entertainment, you've got to go and visit it. And as soon as you start to shill to them, as soon as you start to sell to them, they split. They don't want it. But if you're able to introduce the brand and the brand values in a subtle way that makes people kind of feel like, I know the drill, you're going to entertain me, and then there's going to be a little bit of the brand in there, they're far more appreciative. So the first example that I'm going to show you is something that we did when I was at my former company called Unplugged. And it was like a gig of a lifetime. It was for American Express, and it was done with Jerry Seinfeld. And he had a long standing relationship with American Express, had done some commercials with them in the 90s. They came back to him and they said, you know, why don't we do something with Superman? Because if you know anything about Seinfeld, he's a complete Superman geek. And he said, yeah, I'd like to do it, but I'd like to, you know, deal with something longer than the 30-second commercial, and I'd like to, you know, try out this kind of branded entertainment stuff. So my company was picked to work with him on the animation, and I'll show you the first episode this ran on the internet. It was a microsite that was launched off AmericanExpress.com, and I'll just run it, and we can chat about it when it's done. Oops.
Say thanks again.
No, not a problem. It's good to see you again, Barry.
You
So did you go bowling with those people last night?
No, I stayed home. I watched that rebound wedding.
Oh, stop. With the reality television, I can't.
I know, me too. But this one's pretty good. They found 30 guys who just got divorced. I don't know that.
Please, stop. If I wanted reality, I'd take the screen out of my TV and look through the wood box.
Oh, boy. Look at these reviews. Unbelievable.
Oh, yes, Wyoming.
See, now, this is what we should have seen.
What's wrong with you? Of course they only put the good ones. Every play does that.
No, that's Joel Siegel. You should trust him. Oh, yes, Wyoming. One song after another.
Wow. Hey, I just stole my DVD player!
What am I going to do?
Unbelievable.
How do you miss this?
You can over yourself. He's getting away.
He's not getting away.
Stop reading reviews!
Goes to show that, you know, people, when you do something nice for them, if you're giving them, I mean, it was the CEO of American Express, the whole intention about it is relationship building. You're building a relationship with your customer, and it has kind of long-term positive effects. It got, I think, somewhere, it was probably averaging about 1 million views for the first 2 or 3 weeks, and then they actually, NBC carried it and showed it on TV as part of the series finale of Frasier, what it was. So it got a whole bunch of other eyeballs associated with that, so it was a fairly big hit. And as I said, it was just, you know, a pretty wild, crazy two or three months of working on this, working weekends, working late nights, but then also having the added benefit of having weekly phone calls with Jerry and kind of pitching ideas to him. And to his, at one point, he did one of the calls, and I was saying to him, "What is that sound?" And he said, "Oh, it's my plane." He was in an airplane hangar, and he just had like his jet ID. He's just like the guy's Richard B. Goddard.
Dave, can I ask you, because I'm being dim here, two quick questions. In terms of the original delivery, so how would someone, besides the NBC airing on television, so how would someone have found this on the web?
They did a fairly large banner campaign, so like online banners. They did a print campaign. They did postcards. I don't know if you noticed they do a pan in the shot and it's Superman and Seinfeld at a New Year's Eve party. They did postcards that they sent out to card holders. They put DVDs of it. It was this kind of, I've never seen it since. It was called Lid Top Advertising. It was like you go to a movie theater and you order a large Coke and they had like the DVD of the play of the Seinfeld Superman thing.
Wow.
So they sort of had like this broad kind of integrated advertising campaign to draw attention to it, but you know, with something like that, like with an actor, writer of his comedian of his caliber, you also get tons of word of mouth.
Yeah, yeah.
You just get, you know, lots of people passing it around and, you know, sending emails. You usually find that, you know, with a really successful branded entertainment campaign, I will receive it maybe hours after it's launched.
Uh-huh.
And I'll probably receive it for, if it's really good, I'll get lots of emails of people saying, "You gotta see this." I mean, it spreads like, if it's good, people won't send stuff.
Now, was this one of the first brand, like extensive branded entertainment campaigns?
No, there was one that, a BMW film series that was really kind of one of the very first ones, and it came out in 2001, and they had like Owen, Guy Ritchie, before he married Madonna, directed one. There's a whole series of them. The problem with them was it was 2001, so I remember going to it, but it just crashed my browser 2-3 times.
Yeah.
It was just a little bit too ahead of its time.
Yeah.
But now, you know, these kind of launches happen like frequently. There's, you know, a lot of companies getting involved in branded entertainment.
Can I ask one more question, then I'll shut up? In terms of comparative costs, maybe you're going to talk about this later, but compared to a more conventional advertising campaign, is this more expensive or less expensive or about the same?
A lot less expensive. The cost of an advertising campaign usually isn't the cost of making it, it's the media cost.
Exactly.
So the example would be that if you look at the Super Bowl, 30 seconds will run you, I think, about $3 to $4 million.
Yeah.
So, you know, if you're thinking about an ad that's running, you know, it's obviously prime time is not Super Bowl. Super Bowl is probably the most expensive media buy you can have, the most high profile. But still, the cost of making something is probably a tenth of the cost of showing it, of buying the media time. So American Express has, you know, diverted a lot of their advertising budgets online. So in 1994, 90% of their media budget went to broadcast, and in 2004, when we made that, it was down to 40% or 35%. So they've been kind of, you know, sort of pioneering in their own right. So it's much, much cheaper. It stays, you know, it's 24/7. You can visit it anytime. But it has its own kind of traditional agencies that have always done the 30-second commercial and interactive agencies, because they'll go, well, that's storytelling, that's video, that's our job, that's what we do well. But I can usually spot ones that are made by traditional agencies because they generally are, they run too long, or you know where we sit and the age that we're in, a lot of campaigns, the most successful ones, allow the user to kind of co-create the brand experience. It's interactive, so it's not, it's definitely not just sit back and be passive. You know, you have a place in the story. You're kind of a co-conspirator, if you will. Any other questions about that, Joe? I think I might just show you a couple of the television teasers that we did.
Hello? Hang on.
It's Green Lantern.
I'm not here.
When are you going to deal with this?
My job business.
I'm pathetic.
Sorry, wrong number.
TV spots. We also did TV.
Hello?
Spots.
Hold on.
It's Green Lantern.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we're just going in on a Holland Tunnel. We're probably going to lose you. For a couple of superheroes, you two got a lot of issues.
You have to deal with them.
Boy, this is a great way to save the country.
Yeah, it's amazing how much you miss in super speed.
Yeah?
So this launched about a month ago, and it's a branded entertainment experience to promote the launch of the new 2007 Jeep Patriot.
Way beyond the trail. Come on in.
the choice to wait until morning and get on the road, wait until morning, take the back roads, or leave tonight. So, be adventurous, let's leave tonight. It's like the people who are like completely car crazy. I'm going to show you, this is a...
Dave, hold on for a second. Did they track, like, how many people finished all 44 scenes? Do they know that?
They're tracking everything. I don't have the data because it's, like, a month is not that long. Yeah. But, yeah, usually they have a, I mean, they have an idea, a much better idea. And the thing about interactive is it's completely measurable. The controversy about the 30-second commercial is they have, you know, Nielsen ratings, but they don't really know how many people are watching things. And then they have no way of kind of gauging the feedback.
Now, would you have tested this on a sample group in terms of their interactivity with it before it was launched?
We do all kinds of quality testing.
Yeah.
I tend to really want to stay away from focus groups. I just kind of find them sort of not necessarily useful. I mean, the web, in you know, we live in a time when there's tons and tons of blogs and kind of consumer forums and things like that. So if people don't like what you make, you find out really, really quickly. And, you know, it's also, it's another, you know, they estimate that in the purchase process for buying a car, the web factors in for something like 90% of people. Because they'll either go to an entertainment experience like this, which also has at the bottom of it, you know, you can link out and you can learn about the Patriot, you can learn about, you know, miles per gallon and all that kind of junk. But, you know, the people will go to blogs and they'll, you know, people will be ruthless, right? They'll just say, this car is a planet, it's a complete dud. You know, so advertisers are having to, you know, grapple with the fact that, you know, you can't snow people anymore. Because, you know, the feedback, if it's negative, will come hard and fast. I'm going to show you an example of something that we're doing for Sprint, which is another branded entertainment. We're actually right in the middle of producing it right now. And I don't have any visuals for it, except for something that we launched just yesterday. So Sprint is, like all the telcos, have moved beyond long distance. Obviously, they're making most of their money on cell phones, and they're making most of their money on packages, like data packages. So the next frontier for them is really people who text on phones, people who download music on phones, ringtones, and then eventually, although they have it now, the adoption rate is not so high, but live TV on phones. And that's a little bit of a question mark, whether people actually want that. They have it. But the rates are, I mean, I think people are just pretty suspicious about it, but they don't really want to watch TV on their phones. But they do want to download music, which is kind of surprising. In a world where a lot of people have iPods, they're finding that people will use their phone as a secondary source of music. And a lot of these phones, you can download music directly to the phone. They all have FM wireless transmitters, so you can kind of put them in your car caddy and use them much like you would an iPod. And of course, Apple's coming up with the iPhone, which is a kind of consolidated package of phone, as well as a music delivery service and calculator, and, you know, kind of almost like a BlackBerry or a Palm, you know, trio, like a rich device with tons and tons of features and functionality. So Sprint came to us and they said, we need to promote our music store, but you know, it's a really, it's hard to cut through the clutter. It's hard to make a connection with the consumer because everyone has a music offering. Even Walmart has a music offering. So they wanted something that was really differentiated. They wanted something that would encourage trial so that people could see their music offering. They have, I think, a million plus songs in their catalog. So we created this, project that we called Mix Sherpa. And Mix Sherpa is basically, it's a video based experience where you come to a record store with two characters in it. There's a guy named Ian, who's a 45-year-old ex-techno pop star, and these are fictional characters. He used to be the front man of a techno pop new romantic band from the early 80s called Fierce Blue Ascot. So he's a has-been who runs a record store. And he's got his sidekick, who's an African-American gentleman who's much younger than him, much hipper. His name is DJ Superboy 5. He wishes he was Fatboy Slim, but, you know, he's doing corporate events and bar mitzvahs. And they run the record store together, and when you come to it, they say, my name's Ian Westbury, and I'm going to help you make the ultimate music playlist. So you're supposed to pick from one of six themed playlists, one being workout, one being guilty pleasures, one being a rebel mix, one being a party mix. So if you pick the party mix, you get 15 songs. They span from the 70s to stuff that was released last week, but it's all thematically consistent. It's like ultimate party songs. And you pick five songs, and they will help you. They'll pick the absolutely perfect sixth song to top off your playlist. As you pick the songs, each one of the songs is tagged with a value. So, you know, like if you pick a Prince song, the value is saucy. If you pick a song by Def Leppard, the tag might be party animal. And the engine parses out the tags to come up with a meaning. If you have three songs that were party animal, what it does is it serves up a movie that we made, which is, you know, Ian going, you're a bit of a party animal. You know, if I invited you to a place, I'd hide all my lager. You know, I bet you keep it together in the daytime, but at nighttime you go a bit feral. And I'm going to give you, like, this perfect party song. So we're in the middle of building this out. We shot it down in L.A. With a really talented music video director named Nigel Dick. This guy directed the early videos for Tears for Fears. He directed that Band-Aid video, Do They Know It's Christmas Time. He did Welcome to the Jungle and Sweet Child of Mine. He did Britney Spears' first two videos. He's like his music video legend. Shot it. We shot it all on green screen, and we're compositing it now. But what we thought we would do is, in addition to all this, we had the backstory. So that we would do a music video for his band, Fierce Blue Ascot. I'm going to actually show that to you right now. So that, you know, again, it's like relationship building with this hard to connect with what they call, their target audience they call advanced connected. And these are people that just don't want to be advertised to at all. I mean, they just don't watch TV. They spend most of their time online. Let's see if I've got YouTube right here. Okay.
What do they call that people?
Sorry?
What do they call that people who get all their information and entertainment and whatnot online?
Well, the term that Sprint uses is advanced connected. So they are like 20 to 30 years old. They have, they spend a little bit more on their phones. They have a whole bunch of like audience segments, like called basic communicators. My mom would be a basic communicator. She's got a cell phone. It's like you call her, she calls you back, that's it. She doesn't understand why someone would text on a phone. You know, I've got a phone, so it's, you know, they don't understand why someone would download music. Younger people, obviously, they have, you know, completely different expectations of what their phones or their devices are going to do. So we sold this idea of doing a music video of Ian, this character back in the day. And we were lucky enough to have Nigel Dick direct it. And so he was like, did a great job of capturing every bad video cliche you could ever imagine. And I did a cold call of a guy named Dale Martindale. He used to front a band called Images in Vogue. And I just thought, well, if we're going to do this, we might as well do this right. We might as well get someone who's really good at it. So I pitched him the whole idea, and then he looked at me and he said, so you want me to make fun of my former band or something along those lines? And I said, no, because you were really good. And he said, I'd be happy to do it. So we wrote this song called Under the Moon, and this is it.
Thank you.
NYSB in Westbury, you'll notice on the bottom here.
He's a munitions officer.
From Enterprise.
Yeah.
So the Trekkies have found this out. So this red is like, you know, but that's Dominic Keating, Lieutenant Malcolm Reed. Why would he do this? And it's like someone points out, well, he's an actor, you know.
Blasphemy. It's blasphemy.
Yeah. I'm so impressed that you've picked that up.
And there was just the tagline for Sprint, right? Just a familiar.
Yes. It says 2007 Sprint Nextel. Now we're doing that. They came to us and they said, you know, we've got to be upfront about this. There was actually a regulatory body in the States called the FCC. Anyways, came down with Sony PlayStation about making a fictional character and not acknowledging that it was advertising. And I really don't have any problem with it. I mean, when I see fairly big campaigns like this, I assume that the brand's behind it. And again, it's sort of like, people judge it on whether they think it's funny or not on its own merits. So, you know, there were some people in our kind of group when we were doing it going, no, you know, you've got to maintain the integrity of it and never let on. But I knew from the moment that we signed on Dominic that, you know, the Trekkies were going to come out and expose us. The other thing we've launched, I've got it on all caps, I guess that probably won't matter. We did a MySpace page for Ian. Audience look at this and go, you know what, Sprint, maybe Sprint doesn't suck so much after all. You know, it's to build that kind of purchase consideration where you go, you know, maybe it is cool to have Sprint as one of your carriers, you know. Because, like, phones for this crowd are very much like fashion accessories. People will judge you, you know, I mean, on your phone as much as they will on your shoes, you know. It's very, very kind of lifestyle driven. So they've got to, you know, change perception around the brand in a big way. I'm just going to back up a little bit because when in in talking to David before coming here, you know, he said you should probably talk a little bit about where you came from and how you got here. And I think my story, although I don't really have a great explanation for it, I come from this sort of a very, very bizarre route to come to advertising. I was trained as a painter, so that's how I know David. We showed together.
He's a good painter, too.
I'm not a bad painter. Not as good as David, but... I was trained as a painter, went to art college in Alberta, studied painting, went to band centers, studied painting and film studies, and then, you know, moved to Toronto in 1984, and did what painters do, what actors do and writers do. You get a Joe job, you get something that that supports you, and you don't, you know, at least in your 20s, it just brings in money, but you're not invested in it at all because you go back to your studio all day and you paint. So in my case, I worked in the restaurant industry, so I worked as a waiter, I worked in kitchens, you know, I worked front of the house, back of the house, all that kind of stuff, did catering, and then really hit a wall with it where I couldn't stand it, so I thought, well, I gotta get a job that sort of is pays better and doesn't drive me up the wall, like the service industry eventually did. So I started dabbling with graphic design and started doing print stuff, doing brochures, just kind of working my way up. And then around 94, or 93, 94, I started doing a lot of CD-ROM development, doing design. And then I got hired to a company that had just been doing lots of CD-ROMs, but they were really interested in this new thing called the internet. And I remember someone showed it to me, and it just blew my mind. I had to ask him over and over again, like, you know, well, who regulates this? And he said, nobody. He said, you don't have to, like, go to the government to get one of these sites? He said, nope. And I come from, you know, what I call like DIY, like do-it-yourself, kind of that sort of punk thing. For me, this was just like a total epiphany, the idea that people, and, you know, the guy who was telling me about it and evangelizing was just, he said, this is going to, you know, change everything. And he was like this kind of visionary guy sort of seeing the future. And I became really seduced by it. I fell in love with it. I fell in love with the platform. I didn't love advertising, and I still don't. Actually, I had an interview that I thought was going really well, and the guy said, what do you think about advertising? I said, I hate it. And that pretty much did it for me. But I still do in a way, and I kind of, you know, maybe I fool myself a little bit, but the reason I like the internet is because of the transparency of it, because people know the truth. And, you know, when I see, when you do stuff like this, I mean, it's quite, basically, it allows me to indulge my storytelling passion and throw a brand in there, you know. It kind of pays for it, and, you know, it's a fun way of doing it without having to pitch films. And you know, people who make, like, filmmakers, and, like, I just think they're the bravest people of all. I mean, the time that I spent down in L.A. shooting this Sprint thing is just wild, because I ran into tons and tons of people. Everybody's an actor. We're writing a script down there, as the old cliche goes, but when we were casting for Ian, you know, when I was watching all these actors kind of come in and do it, and Nigel said, some of these guys typically will, and women who are, you know, part of it, will do maybe like 5 auditions a day. He said it's just an incredible amount of rejection, you know, to go through, and it's really, really hard on your psyche, because, you know, at some point, everybody has this moment where you go, you know what, I'm no good, I can't be any good, you know, and then something happens, and I, you know, chatting with Dominic, he was kind of at the end of his rope, and then he got the Enterprise, and, you know, paid for his house, and, you know, it's sort of, there's very much a kind of feast or famine aspect to the entertainment industry that I don't really have the appetite for. I love living up in Toronto, and I couldn't handle being down there, but I get to, you know, live up here and make these kind of goofy little branded entertainment things, get paid for it, and I, you know, work with a pretty fun crew of people. Manage a crew of 40 designers, writers, information architects, and programmers working on various brands, and it's interesting. It doesn't entirely feel like advertising to me, and I kind of wonder, you know, if at some point if I'll get lured over to the dark side. But I don't think there will be any dark side. The truth is that traditional agencies are having to really kind of readjust what they do because their budgets are going down. And it's not because TV is going away, but we just have continued fragmentation. You know, just think of how many channels you can get. I get 70 alone, and most of them are crap, you know. But it's sort of like the budgets are getting smaller and smaller, and we're getting into like narrow casting, niche casting. So it's like, you know, there's TV, there's the internet, there's all kinds of ways to get stories out there. There's all kinds of people, you know. I mean, YouTube's a fantastic example of people doing storytelling, making their own films for, you know, almost nothing. You know, borrowing cameras and making stuff and being able to, you know, like, it's a tremendous platform. Again, it's sort of, I couldn't have imagined, none of us could have, even 10 years ago, that millions of people potentially could see something that you made. No TV station would take it off, you know, so it's really opened the... smash down barriers, and it's a great place to be. So that's my, you know, it's kind of a funny way that I ended up doing this, and I still draw, and I still paint, and, you know, I kind of have this fantasy that at some point I'm going to become a gentleman painter, you know, that I would give up the showing, you know.
Enjoy the drawing.
I'm sorry?
You enjoy the painting still more than
the about equal, but, you know, I come and see, you know, David shows, and I see, you know, we have a mutual friend, Richard shows, and I kind of, you know, this little thing inside me go, ah.
No, you go, what are you guys, crazy? That's a new view, right? Yeah.
No, I kind of think, you know, I should be doing this, because I love it. I'm very passionate about visual art. I like looking at it. I like looking at it as much as making it. I like mucking about it. I wasn't so crazy about the art world, really, to tell you the truth. It's sort of, for me, the art world is, you know, it's kind of, the politics of it can kind of wear you down, but that's, you know, that's just bitching. So that's about it. I, you know, it's my time up. Any questions or any of this makes sense? Or?
It seems to be a time when a lot of different elements are coming together. Mm-hmm. Reality inside the video game Half-Life, or
Second Life. Yeah.
So things are like the '60s, kind of crossing over, and
it's like hybrid experiences. Yeah. It's sort of pretty exciting. I was in San Francisco, I guess about a month ago, at our organics kind of what they call management team meetings, but they brought in the Philip Rosenthal, the guy who founded Second Life. And if you don't know, Second Life is a place where you can do a lot of things, but what people do is they create avatars, and then you kind of live as someone else, hence the Second Life thing. And he showed us this absolutely wild video conference thing where you become an avatar and you talk in real time in this kind of 3D spatial environment. And I thought, man, of all the like really dull, bad conference calls I've had to be on, if I could be the guy in a spandex suit, you know, the wizard's hat, you know, maybe we'd have some fun. So I brought up a sprint, and they said, oh, we'd love to do it, you know.
That's awesome.
I'd love to pitch something, you know, with a wizard's hat and a spandex suit. It wouldn't look the work.
The reason I got interested in online games because of my son, and the fact that I was attracted to it, you know, seemed bizarre to me, you know, and you know, I can go in and I can be the avatar, you know, it's not necessarily violent or whatever, but it also seemed to me that perhaps it was like during the Depression when everyone went to see Hollywood musicals. I think there's a sort of a need for escapism right now.
Yeah. Yep.
Not really, the internet is something you can escape into.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's, I'm 45 years old. There's parts of it that I don't connect with. My son is 14, and he spent some time on World of Warcraft, and he builds communities and all this kind of stuff, and I just look at that and go, that's just whacked out. And I'm supposed to be the guy who's, like, into this stuff, but I'm just like, it's just, as a part of what I do, I ended up getting a Facebook page because we were pitching a client and they had like a big Facebook presence. And then I started getting people saying, you know, such and such wants to be your friend. So I kind of got sucked into this thing. And my wife was like, why would you want to, it's just creepy. Like, why would you want to post your interests and let everyone see and like, you know. And I said, well, it's a personal expression. I mean, some people like it. It's, there's a huge, huge generational divide between, you know, and Facebook is a little bit kind of sober, like MySpace, forget it. I mean, it's like, that site's just a, like, within an hour of posting Ian's MySpace page, we had like five adult entertainers wanting to be his friends. It was like spammed with all this kind of like sex stuff. Yeah. We like had to get it off. I mean, so yeah, it's, what's that? Well, I don't know. I don't think they have any kind of spam filters. Like, you know, like, how would they find this guy? He's a fictional creation. Like, how could we launch at 5 o'clock on Wednesday, and by 7 o'clock, there is, you know, a woman with, like, thigh-high boots and a whip, you know? Like, how does that happen?
They're the leading innovators anyway, aren't they? The sex sites, in terms of internet.
There's an oft-quoted thing that the porn industry sort of brought a lot of technical developments to the web because it's the stuff that, oddly enough, people would pay for. You know, I don't understand how someone can give their credit card information to some of these places because it's like, oh yeah, that's really secure. These people are out for your best interest. Them together because they were shot from the same camera, you can't tell at all. It's amazing what you like, the stuff that you look at that you wouldn't know was green screen. That there was a hilarious, incredibly cynical little video that Ricky Gervais made for a comedy for Bannon, and he's walking around in Kenya, you know, talking, and they go cut, and he's on green screen, and Bob Geldof comes in, and he goes, "What the F are you doing?" And he said, "Oh, I'm shooting this thing." You know, he says, "You can't do it. It's immoral." And he said, "Well, you know, it's like, I'm not going to go to Kenya. It's not much of a vacation, is it? You know, I mean, this whole kind of thing." And then all of a sudden, Bono comes in, and then who's that guy? Jamie, the naked chef.
Oh, Jamie
Oliver comes in, and they're all kind of, you know, getting in on this thing. It was very, very funny. But in the opening thing, you think, "Oh, he's in Kenya." I mean, it's possible that you could snow people this way.
David, I'm going to have to be the bad guy because I think I would like to hear you keep on talking, but I know that other people here have other class obligations. So unless someone has one last burning question to ask.
Sure. How'd you get into the industry? Because you said that you were working as a chef and painting.
Well, I was doing all that stuff, but I was building a portfolio. So I was like doing flyers and print pieces and all kinds of stuff. To tell you the truth, when the internet came along, I thought, okay, this is my opportunity. Because I'd already tried to get into design houses to do stuff, and I was very, very competitive. So I was a little bit, I just thought, this is a great opportunity, and I kind of stuck it out. In the early days of it, it was a real drag. Which, you know, it was, in the early days, I had to learn how to write my own HTML code, which is like, I'm a completely anti-technical person. So I was like banging out all this stuff, but I just sort of knew instinctively that this thing was going to be big, and if I hitch my wagon to it, I might get out of the restaurant business. But it was like, I was desperate. I mean, I just knew that I did, and I also like, I was pretty passionate about it. So I just kind of stuck in there, and I tell that to people that I hire, I say, you know, stick around.